Welcome to the Broken Pie Chart Podcast, episode 268. I'm your host, Derek Moore. And with me once again is my semi-permanent co-host, Jay Pestercelli, CEO of Zega Financial. Jay, all right, we're recording this on a Friday. The market was down today.
I mean, it was kind of a rough week. I think we're starting to see a little fear find its way back into the market, Derek. Like, oh, markets can go down 5%. Did we forget? So, yeah. So a little bit of diciness is working its way into the market. And what do you think that was the main driver of it this week, Derek? I mean, to me, it's pretty obvious. But you want to take a stab?
I mean, there's some geopolitical stuff, but sometimes that's a reason that's causality, correlation, or causal, whatever that is.
Are we in the Matrix now?
Causality. I don't know.
But that's a good movie, by the way.
Since you went right there, though, I will tell you that we follow the implied Fed funds rate and the probabilities for hikes or cuts. And I think, if I look from April 1st, what the probabilities were and what they were today, two cuts, Jay. Fed's only going to do two cuts according to the probabilities.
For this year, only two cuts. Well, look, they're almost to where you and I are, right? We've been talking about this for a while. And it's the driver of that. Yeah, I mean, look, we'll get to the driver in a minute, but the data is interesting. And I think that was the thing that started taking away, you know, the wind in the market sails, which is, oh, the Fed may leave rates a little higher for longer, which if the economy is strong and we have good earnings, it's okay, right? As long as the direction of rates, we established that last week, as long as the direction of rates flat to down is kind of the trend, then the market will like that. And if earnings are up, the market will like that. I think the beginning of the week, there started to be a little bit of fear, maybe the middle of the week, fear that maybe, you know, there are not as many rate cuts coming. That's clearly being seen. You saw that happen. You saw that reflected in the 10-year, in the 30-year, really in rates across the board. So now the market is not expecting as many cuts, thinking the Fed won't be as, you know, dovish as originally hoped. And we knew that was a big driver of the market growth in the first place, at least the kind of appreciation of the market. And then this week that kind of brings it into question, right? And that to me is what drove a lot of the fear this week.
I mean, all right, sure. That's the reason to du jour. I'm going to be a contrarian and just say, you know, sometimes there's more sellers than buyers. There's just things take a break. We've been going up and up and up. And we were pretty, you and I have talked about this, like we've been going up a lot relative to where we were at the end of last year. Sometimes you just need a break and more sellers than buyers. But today I looked at high yield. High yield is pretty flat. And Apple, yesterday and today, Apple's doing great the last 2 days. It's up in a down market. So it's not like this is everything's getting sold off. High yield's getting pounded. But I will say it was a flight to quality a bit, Jay. I think you mentioned that we were talking earlier about that too.
Yeah. Well, we have made the argument that the market was not expensive, even though it had a strong run. And we've made the argument that buying at all time highs, you know, generally over time, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years later, you do better than buying on any other day. So I would say we weren't, you know, pounding the table, the market was frothy at all. We thought it was, you know, interesting the way the market was being priced. And we talked about it. And of course, we made a big deal of all the new highs that we had hit. So, but, you know, yeah, it's my favorite thing when you say there were more sellers than buyers. You know, I love that as the explanation all the time. For those of you that don't know, I hate when he says that. Besides that, yeah, look, it was interest rate driven. It was the chatter from a couple Fed chairs. It was Jamie Dimon saying, maybe we see 8% rates, right? Jamie Dimon came out before their earnings and talked about a potential 8%. I don't know where he's going with that, but there were things that spooked the market. The number one thing to me, though, that spooked the market was CPI.
Yeah.
CPI, right?
Let's go right there. So yeah. You brought it up. As I was saying, I'm not stealing this phrase from somebody. We're not always right, but we're often first. We were mentioning the super core. Super core is you know, this core, X food and energy. Supercore takes out housing, which is a big part. Jay, Supercore has been trending up. And what's in there a lot is you think about services. You look at core CPI. Core CPI, goods and services, the core stuff. Goods, believe it or not, declined 0.192% year over year. But services are up 3.993% year over year. And a little bit, you know, the audience can't see the chart, but the bar is a little bit higher. You go to CPI, which includes the whole bit, right? Food, energy, everything. And 3.8% year over year. And that's including energy was only up a little bit, a tiny, tiny bit. It's really more services. So this, Jay, goods aren't really the problem anymore. It's services. Supercore is trending the wrong way because a lot of people said, well, housing is lagging. You know, it's going to take some time. It's lagging. Okay, that's not in Supercore. This is what the Fed doesn't want. The Fed doesn't want a reacceleration. And I think that this plays into the fact that they are afraid of lowering rates and inflation coming back and them holding the bag for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason to lower rates while you have this kind of potential, you know, tick up in, not potential, the actual tick up in inflation. By the way, in the services, looks to me, medical care services had one of the biggest increases, right? When you think about what's in services, whether it's transportation or recreation or education, all of those things are kind of in there. Medical looked to me to be the piece that popped the most. And it looks like when medical pops, it doesn't stop, right? It's not a short-term pop. When you look back at the history of the medical trends for quarters at a time. And so if this continues, it might be a component that continues to expand and push CPI higher.
You're looking at the same chart I am. Look back on that same line, April of 23, May 23, down, 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 down. You know, September of 23, it was down 0.70, down 0.51 in October 23. Yeah, and now it's plus 0.539.
Yes, it's over 0.5%, right?
Yeah.
So it's pushing things up, right? So it's definitely moved. So we'll watch that, obviously. And yes, so this Supercore has been trending up, what, since November?
Yeah.
Right? So December, January, February, March, April. We got 5 months of, you know, increasing Supercore. So I've always made the argument that housing is actually, you know, being negatively affected when it comes to interest rates by the higher rates, right? So there's that too. And that's not even in here.
Yes. Talk about that, because if rates are higher and you own a building, don't you have to raise rent?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're buying a house.
You rent a house, you're going to pay more right now, right? Yeah. Actually, I continue to see the studies that renting is more affordable than owning, right? That continues to be the case. So higher interest rates means more expensive for you to not everybody has to move all the time, right? That's why it's kind of a slow, lumbering kind of indicator. But, you know, this is now we're going on over a year of rates being higher, and it will find its way into this number, no doubt.
Yeah. So
look, inflation's not kicked, which is why I think one of the reasons you and I have thought you might have said zero rate raises. I was in the one camp just for optics that they would have to do it. But I'll tell you keep seeing a tick up in CPI, optics out the door. They're not going to raise rates. They're not going to lower rates.
Well, I'm just going to tell you too that I don't think this is necessarily a problem. I don't know what's going to happen in the markets. That's where we buy and we hedge. If you want to buy the market, buy it. If you don't want to buy it, don't buy it. All right. So let's get that out of the way.
Great.
This isn't necessarily bad for equities, though, because it seems like the profit margins are still strong. And it almost appears that the companies are just, you know, they're able to, they have pricing power. They're raising prices. And maybe they're actually cutting in some ways too. And with tech, I mean, it's not like they have to go out and buy a factory. Wages is the worry, I guess, with tech, you know, some of that stuff. But you don't, I go back to this thing. Why do you need lower rates for the market? Why do you need lower rates for the market to go up? You don't. You need profits to increase. You need profits to stay strong. You need the expectations to stay strong. Now, if I want to throw a little salt on the what? Not salt on the wound. That's not the. If I want to throw a dark cloud over something, I'd say we're still at a 21 forward PE. And it's like, hey, would I rather buy the market when it was a 15 PE versus a 21? Yeah, probably. But it doesn't mean that earnings can't continue to, expectations can't continue to go up too. So I just, like, I go back to this thing, like, why do we need an interest rate cut for the markets to do okay? We don't. We had 5% rates in the 90s. It was fine.
Well, I think the hint of it going lower is also nice, but you're right. We don't need it. Like, it's actually kind of healthy. No? Right? It's kind of healthy when you can have that. Like, hey, savers can now actually, you know, earn some, you know, income without having to take risk in the markets. Like, you know, there's plenty of people that the savers for a decade were really disadvantaged. They were forced to take risk in the equity markets. And so it's not a bad thing, rates where they are, right? We don't need it to go down. And I think, so I guess we're in violent agreement on this. Doesn't need
violent
to go.
Violent agreement. Oh, violent agreement. Okay.
All right. Great.
Let's talk about bonds though, because the bond market, so rates are higher. And without complicating this whole conversation, Jay, I'll just say, if you buy a bond and the coupon payment or the current interest rate is higher, you have less risk today than when let's say you're buying a 10-year treasury at 0.75%. It's less sensitive to every 1-point change. But I go back and I pulled up a chart in for the total return index. So imagine if you bought the 30-year treasury, and how much are you down off the high? The high, I believe, was in 2020, probably March or so of 2020. And you're down 44.5% off the high in U.S. 30-year treasury.
If I now, bought a treasury.
Yes.
And what were rates paying back then? I try to remember. It was like 3, right?
You bought a. No, it was lower. I think it was lower. I'm going to have to look it up. Yeah. I'm going to have to look it up.
So how quickly we forget what rates were 3 years ago. You buy this treasury. You're trying to, you know, kind of lock in this rate because you think it's okay. And then you find yourself down 44%. 3 years later. Wonderful. Treasuries.
Yeah,
not all they're cracked up to be.
By the way, March 9th of 2020, 0.99% on the 30-year treasury.
Well, okay.
It's over 4. You have duration there. That's an interest rate risk.
And it's not something we've obviously covered that for a while.
Yeah. I'm not going to go into that again. But maybe if I can find the link to where I explained all that, I'll put a link. You know what? I'll do that. I'll try and find the link where I do a deep dive in that. I don't think you were on that one, Jay. So I bring this up because if you look too at from that time, actually I did this from the end of March of 2020 through yesterday, and you look at, you know, bonds, and look, I understand most people are not like buying the S&P and then putting 30-year bonds as your 60-40. You probably have some 10-year, you probably have some corporates, a bunch of different stuff. But if you look at IEF, which is a proxy for the 7 to 10-year treasury bills or treasury bonds, since March 30th of 2020, its total return is minus 18.64. That includes the coupon payments and the interest and all that. The 30-year, so let's use TLT, which is not a pure 30-year. It's what, 20-year plus?
It's a 20-plus, yeah.
Yeah, it's down 40.21% cumulative, not annualized. The S&P, Jay, up 114.36% total return since then. And then I'll give you two more. SJNK, which is a high short duration, high yield ETF from State Street, plus 33.86. And Sirloin, SRLN, which is a senior loan high yield, up 34%. So think about that, like 30-year, like TLT down 40%. IEF, 7 to 10-year treasuries down 18.5%+. So they've been non-correlated, but not the type of non-correlation that you want. Like equities actually help de-risk the bonds in this case.
Yeah, no, I know. And I'm glad you touched on those, right? Because those are some vehicles that we utilize in some of our strategies, whether it's the short-term high yield. And obviously, this includes the 2022 period. And the secured loan, we like to call that Sirloin. That's a fun little it's not an acronym. It's a nickname for the ticker, SRLN.
Yes.
So those are, you know, interesting holdings where those are more, you know, we would talk about those and say, look, they're kind of a nice hybrid between equities and fixed income because they have, you know, more volatility in them than typically, and I say this after you just said the numbers, they have more volatility in them than what a treasury, a short duration treasury would have, you know, like a 1-3 year treasury. But they have, you know, the upside capture because of the strength of the companies that are considered high yield or in that secure loan. So they capture a little equity-ish like reflection. We, in our studies, we've seen that, you know, high yield funds and these higher yielding funds like Sirloin have what, like, 40, 50, 60% correlation to equities and then 40, 50, 60 mm-hmm. to treasuries. So they're a nice mix, you know, and they you know, generally have less volatility than equities, but return less. And this is just a great, those numbers are great. Let's go through that again. S&P up 114, Sirloin and S-Junk around up 33. Those are nice numbers over that four-year period. Unfortunately, compared to a 10-year, the 7 to 10-year treasury down 18. So you're right, Derek. If you went to diversify your portfolio with bonds, yeah, it's turned out to be not great. I mean, at some point, right, if rates do go down, we know the driver of bond appreciation is rates. So when it comes to treasuries. So if rates come down, that's you'll see a reversal in that. But it's been an interesting time for a treasury investor, for sure.
Yeah, and it's... I mean, this is one of the reasons why we prefer in our hedged equity strategies, which is where we buy the markets and we hedge or we buffer. We sort of prefer to buy those markets and hedge as opposed to just buying and then putting a bunch of, you know, like a 60-40, hoping the diversification helps you there. We'd rather just directly hedge. It's just a different way of looking at it. But, you know, it's, yeah, I will do them. I'm not going to do it now because I got to do it in my head and I'll probably be a little bit off. But I'm trying to think where interest rates would have to go like in 6 months for that 30-year to get back to break even. It's
yeah. I mean, in your head.
2%?
6 months, three, right? They'd have to change by three.
Yeah, I think they'd have to go to like...
two.
Yeah, maybe two, maybe 1.7, yeah, something like that. Two.
So if you needed to make your money back in 6 months, you'd need the Fed fund, you need rates to go down to two in the 30 year. So
Yeah.
That's fairly unlikely at this point.
Anything else on this one? I think we're good.
No, we're good.
Let's talk VIX because VIX. We thought, I don't know if it quite hit 20 today.
Came up short. Came up short, 19.2 on the VIX today.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Definitely, you know, pushing the higher end of what we call the lower volatility regime. Generally, we like to see it under 25, right, to stick in that regime. Of course, it stayed under because we just talked about that. But if it could stay in the, you know, it popped up to 19 plus and closed at 70.2. But we definitely are seeing some spikes here. Again, a little bit of fear, and all of a sudden, people are kind of hopping in and buying, you know, adding to speculation in their option portfolios, which generally they're speculating downward, right? So, yes, pop in the VIX that we haven't seen in a while. Highest VIX since, drum roll, end of October, October 31st. So, we're a touch today, was the highest since October 31st, which, as you know, was right after. You know, a nice little sell-off that we had in 2023, right? It was a 10% sell-off. That was kind of right around when the VIX peaked at 22. So still, I would say we're in the lower volatility regime, but, you know, the high end of it. Until we see us get out of this, you know, low 20s, then I wouldn't change any opinion of that. Just a little juicier right now.
I took this probably about a half hour before the market closed. I grabbed kind of the what was going on in the chart. And of course, with the VIX, there is the spot VIX index. That's the one you see on TV. That is not tradable. And then we have the VIX futures contracts. And there's weeklies, you know, in April, May, a couple in May, four in May. One left in April. And then we have the monthlies. So April, May, June, July, they go, I mean, you can go all the way out. Pretty far out. And what I noticed today, too, is the, I'll call it the compression of the curve. So normally, if you would look at the very front end of the VIX curve, the nearest to maturity, those are typically lower. And then you kind of draw a line up and they're a little bit higher. This thing is pretty flat. I mean, you look at the April weekly, about 1735. You go out to the June monthly, 1777. Gets above 18, July, August, September. We'll talk about this in a second. The election goes up to 21.5 for October, which, you know, that sort of volatility is in there. But pretty much the way you look at this is if you're buying a one-month volatility contract for the future, or you're buying one that, you know, doesn't expire until December, the difference between the expected volatility isn't that great. So we have a flat curve. We don't have an inverted curve, but we do have a flat one, Jay.
So this just tells you that, and by the way, it was more curved, normally curved, right, before this week.
Yes.
It just tells you that you're starting to see a little, I like to say volatility kind of ripples out into the time series of the futures and into the options, because you know, you don't, the move that happens right away takes a little time for it to be reflected for later months, right? We like to say sometimes these futures are a little lazy, right, with the movement of the spot, right? So it's just one of those things that you watch the curve to kind of see like, hey, is it getting more expensive? Is there more, you know, is there a higher VIX? I always say it's speculation. I know most people talk about fear and concern, but just is there going to be more volatility kind of going out over a few months? And the flatness of what the futures curve looks like today tells you, okay, it could start to ripple out, but it hasn't yet. The short term has moved up and the longer term hasn't moved much yet.
What's so interesting too is that, let's say a few months ago you said, you know what, I kind of think it's going to be really volatile in mid-April. Okay, so let's say it's December, and you said, I think it's going to be really volatile in mid-April. I'm going to buy some April call options on the VIX, or I'm going to buy the April VIX future. Remember, you're in December, you're thinking, I think it's going to be volatile. You know, the April weekly or the April monthly is only about 1745. VIX futures are typically lower than the spot. But I mean, think about that. You probably lost money in that contract before you got back to break even, maybe. I don't know what the prices were in December. But it's kind of another reminder of it's hard to trade these. It's hard to try and say, I'm going to go out and I'm going to pick a date in the future. Because what do you buy? I mean, what do you buy? Do you buy the longer one that's in the normal VIX futures curve and it goes up? These are tough things to
yeah, because the futures price in what we call a reversion to the mean. Like, yeah, yes, you may get a pop, but they're not going to pop because even though it may be up today, the futures go, yeah, but it's not going to be that way in 3 months. It'll be more like the average. And so even if you get that pop in the VIX, the futures are going to be, again, lazy to move up unless it really kind of entrenches itself in. And then it starts to say, okay, it's going to move up a little higher. So there's that piece when it comes to the futures that keeps it slow. So if you try to trade these, you know, you need to be right for a longer time versus one day. It's not like trading an equity that pops. That's the price you can get out of. It doesn't work that way with these, nor does it work that way in the options. And speaking of the options on the VIX, Derek, looking at the VVIX is another thing that you and mm-hmm. I like to look at. That hit a high that we haven't seen since back in the middle of October of last year. So the high there, so let's see, we hit like a
112.86, I think.
112-ish today.
Yeah.
And then back in August, October, like 118s. So that was high. And so what drives the VVIX? Well, that's the options on the VIX. And I will tell you, with next week being kind of the regular expiration in the market, for equities, right? The normal monthly is next week, the equity options. All the volume today was in the option that expires in 4 days. So VVIX represents the volatility of the VIX options. And what I'm saying is all the volatility, all the trading today was in the VIX options that expire in a week. Quite a bit of volume on the call side, right? People buy VIX calls because they expect the market to go up, right? As you can see, there's, you know, a couple strike at the 17 strike, over 100,000 contracts traded today. At the 20 strike, over 100,000 contracts traded today. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that that's on the call side. On the put side, there's actually a decent amount of volume at the 15. So, you know, all of those, when you look at that, it just tells you that people are willing to pay more for that potential VIX appreciation, and that's what's pushing up the VIX, because just the options are more expensive and there was a lot of volume today. All of that kind of combines together to push that VIX higher, which we use that again as, what are the option traders, the ones that are really looking to protect using a derivative like the VIX, what are they doing? That's why we watch the VIX. So it's an interesting index to watch. If you haven't watched it before, keep an eye on it.
I want to talk about the election and just October. If we look at the VIX futures curve, so there's September option or September future. And by the way, we're not advocating to trade these. Like, watch a game show. Don't go trade VIX futures. go out, find a hobby. Like, invest in, like, watch some woodworking videos. You'll probably be safer than trading VIX futures. The September contract is 18.81. The October goes to 21.52. And then November, which, and there's some dates in here and some go through the election, some don't. But it goes back to 19.5, December 19.37. So the reason why I bring this up is there is clearly a kink, a little notch higher in the VIX futures curve right at the election. But I just want to, like, think about, if you think there's going to be volatility around the election, like, is that what you would buy? Okay. So if you buy the VIX future at 21.52, you make a penny. Well, actually, you don't make a penny, but VIX futures are priced a little different. But you make a little bit of money as long as it's above 21.52, assuming no commissions. Like, just think about that. You're like, oh, I think it's going to be volatile. Great, I'll buy this. Or I'll buy an option on the future, which, by the way, if you're looking at a VIX option chain, those are options on the future. I just think this is why it's so hard, because you could be right, but it's sort of, you're already buying it high. I mean, think about, we were under 15 a week ago. We're not even at 21.5 today. So it's a tough thing, but it's clearly in there.
I'm going to give you a data point there that's going to kind of underscore what you just said.
Underscore or overscore it?
I'm going to like darken the line under it, and I'm going to I'm going to help, like, reinforce. I don't know if I'm using the right term. So
yeah, let's go with it.
I'm really going to go with it. So if you were to look at the options on the VIX, as we just talked about, and a lot of VIX traders use the 25 strike as kind of the level to say, oh, okay, if there's real fear, I want to own the 25 VIX, right? Because that's the one that'll, you know, it's probably cheap now while the VIX is down to 15, and then it'll appreciate up as the VIX gets to 25. So I'm just, there's usually a lot of volume in the 25 strike. So I'm looking at the 25 strike out to October, right? You know, the October 16th. So this is leading in to the election, obviously. That option is last traded at $2.55, right? So that's the call. I'm talking about the call on the VIX 25. So your break even is, you know, in October, the VIX would close at 27.5, right? Because it's, you pay 250 plus the 25 strike. Great. So that's the cost. Just remember the cost for October. If you go out farther to November, so I'm adding a whole nother month. So normally, if you're an option trader, you know, I've just added a month of time value. The actual last trade on that, Derek, was 230. So buying the November 25 call is 25 cents cheaper than buying the October 25 call. So you have inverse time there, right? It's a very interesting dynamic just to see how the market is really kind of speculating around October volatility versus November, right? The other thing I'll tell you, well, okay, Jay, what about September? Is that also true? Nope, September's even lower. September makes sense. It's $1.85 last traded for the 25 strike September VIX option. But that October 25 VIX option is expensive, and it's a perfect reflection of when the option traders are putting on exposure to a potentially more volatile market.
Jay, I'll give you one other interesting thing here. Only one, though. Not, you know, that's my quotient for the week. Somebody, if they would have bought, let's say, the near-term VIX future, you'd be up 22% since, I think, from yesterday. If you bought the October one, the one that's, you know, further out, you're up 2%. So think about that. Hey, I think there's going to be volatility sometime between now and the election. Okay, good luck figuring out which one to buy. You know, do you keep buying? You buy it here, like 17. You buy the April monthly at 17.45. It goes back to 15. You lost, you know, 2.5 points there. All right. I think
This is the thing with options. Not only do you have to get the price right, you have to get the time right. Time and price when it comes to options.
And volatility.
Well, that's all part of it, right? But just as you're looking for the end of it all, right? If you have a thesis, I'm just talking about even equities, right? Any random option, right? Price and time both matter. You could be right on the direction and wrong on time, and you could lose money with an option.
All right, let's go to earnings, Jay. Next, we're kind of getting in earnings season. We had some bank numbers today. JP Morgan, you referenced Jamie Dimon earlier. Next week, just kind of looking Monday, it looks like Goldman Sachs, Schwab, Bank of America on Tuesday before the open. You get United Airlines. I'm looking through here. You know, Netflix is on Thursday after the close. That will be an interesting one. One that I always like to watch because it's semiconductors is TSMC, Taiwan Semi. They are before the open on Thursday. And they're of the semis, they go first. So that's kind of an interesting one to see what they say because they manufacture everybody's stuff pretty much. I mean, they don't have their own chips. They manufacture everyone else's. So
I'm glad you brought up earnings, right? So today you go, what was the catalyst for today? Yes, there was some geopolitical turmoil there, right, with Iran. But it started out that the banks disappointed, right? The bank numbers, I was watching the pre-market and, you know, JP Morgan was down 4% at one point pre-market. Wells was down. Now I think BlackRock was up. They had good earnings, right? But it's just one of those things that when we talk about the drivers of the market, I always say interest rate and earnings, and interest rates are not getting, everybody's not getting what they want from earlier in the week. And then today, maybe earnings will be a little disappointing. So the two things that were kind of I've been calling it the wind in the sails of the market, both of them kind of came off today. And now the banks don't always dictate which way the rest of earnings will go. They can certainly, if things are really bad, they could certainly drive that. But they are kind of on an island, in my opinion. But they disappointed today. By the way, the report, like, they beat earnings. JP Morgan beat earning estimates, right? But still down for the day.
Well, they're disappointed rates are still high. And the expectation is rates are, like, they still have stuff in their balance sheet.
They have duration.
You know, they have 1% long bonds that are just sitting there at a loss.
And down 6.5% JP Morgan today. That's a big day for that stock, a big bad day for that stock. And it was their net interest margin that they said was flattening, the NIM. We could talk about that, the net interest.
Now, explain that, Jay, for the audience.
So the NII or NIM, net interest margin, is the income that the difference that the bank makes between what they lend, the rate at which they lend, and the rate at which they pay on balances, right? So if they're making loans at 8% and they're paying you in your money market account 5%, their net interest income is 3%. It's that difference. It's the whole banking model, right? That's the whole thing. And so that net interest income or net interest margin is the thing that, you know, was a little flat for JP Morgan. I think, again, you know, they're always quick to change rates, you know, on what they pay versus what they charge, right? You lock in a loan for a longer period of time versus, hey, your money rate is changing and your cash rate, your interest rate in your checking account or savings account is a lot more dynamic. So generally that was a little bit of a disappointment for is it going to impact the earnings across the board? I don't think so. I don't know why people made that connection, but that was the first catalyst for the day.
Well, remember the other thing I mentioned, the balance sheet. You know, if you deposit money and they put the money into long duration bonds that are, I'm speaking in generalities, like long duration bonds that are paying, you know, 2%, and they're not issuing a lot of mortgages right now, or the mortgages that they have open in their portfolio are, you know, a lot of them are less than 4%. Now, the good thing is I'm on Chase Savings, Chase, JP Morgan Chase, Chase.com. I'm looking right on the website. Interest rate is compounded and credited monthly. This is good news, Jay, based on daily collected balance. They're variable and determined by Chase's discretion. Effective 4/12, all balances, the rate, get ready for it, 0.01%. The annual percentage yield, by the way, is 0.01%. Like, they're not paying anything on their cash.
They're not paying anything. By the way, but you can, by the way, as a Chase customer, I think I've told you this before, you can put money in a, you can go, they'll open a money market account for you on their brokerage side that you can sweep money pretty quickly. But yes, they're paying, but you've got to go take that effort of opening that account and moving the money and managing that difference. But look, for 5% or 4.5%, whatever that is, it might be worth it these days. But yes, they're not paying anything in their checking or savings accounts. And they are lending that money out at, even though it's not much of it, 6, 7, 8% right now.
Yeah.
That's their net interest income. They're in their press release, they saw that flattening.
You know, I'm looking at Wells Fargo from wellsfargo.com. They call it Way to Save, and it's copyrighted with the R in it. So they thought that was a good slogan there. 0.01%. Several ways to avoid the monthly service fee. All right, I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole. But anyway, but I think we've described the problem for them. It's constructive for interest rates to go down. And it's constructive for the interest rates to go down, especially on the long, at the short end for the banks. It's just how things, you know, they lend long and pay on short. That's kind of the old thing that may or may not be still the same way. But yeah, Jay, I think it's a great point you bring up. It's the NIMS, and banks are very highly correlated or very much tied to what interest rates are of any other business for sure. Because it directly impacts how much they can make. So, all right.
I don't see anything else really to call out on the earnings, just more financial. I mean,
Netflix is interesting.
No. Yeah. I mean, you already called that one out. But you know, you got more financials happening in the first half of the week, right? Goldman Sachs, you said Schwab, M&T Bank, Ally Bank, Key Bank, Travelers, you know, U.S. Bank, all that's kind of coming out. Earlier in the PNC, Bank Mellon, you know. Northern Trust, Morgan Stanley.
Early and late, there's usually not funny ones, but just ones you never like Levi's reports very late in the quarter. I remember they always pop up like very, very late. Them and Nike. Yeah. WD-40, I think, was last week.
Like, I love that that's its own company. It's just great. They got a product. That's it. We make WD-40. By the way, that may not be true. Sorry if anybody knows more about WD-40. It's just that's the stock, WD-40.
Is WD-40. I'm going to look it up here. WD-40 is the WD-40 company. Let's look at the description here. Manufactures multi-purpose lubricant products and heavy-duty hand cleaners. Okay.
That's it. That's what they make. WD-40.
There you go. Now we went down this rabbit hole. I got to look.
You want to look at the market cap of WD-40?
Well, the PE is 47.3. I don't know what their forward PE is. That's really what matters.
That seems a little high.
I can do this. EEO. All right. I'll spend 2 seconds on this. And if I don't get it, I will not. So the estimate here, I'll do the annual estimate. They're expected, $4.83 was fiscal year 2023. They're expected to be 5.225 fiscal year 24. So they're expecting growth.
Yeah. They got a 1.5% dividend too.
They're trading at 43 times next year's earnings. By the way, you and I'm pulling this up blind. So nobody should do anything with WD-40 based upon what we're saying.
No, we're not recommending it. It just kind of came up as like, hey, that's a fun company. By the way, not a lot of options, not a deep option chain on it. It's nothing that we would ever kind of do synthetics on or anything like that.
Somebody who follows this should tell me whether this is good value or bad value. I have no idea. I'll let you know in 12 months. But at 43 forward PE. Okay.
All right. There we go.
Let's talk about we are getting into political season, and Michael McDonough at Bloomberg put out a chart today the university one year forward inflation expectations by party affiliation. So University of Michigan does consumer sentiment surveys, and they broke it down. I guess they asked the people, are you Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? So, and this flips too, depending upon who the president party is. So Biden's in, he's a Democrat. Democrats expect inflation to be 2% a year from now. Probably that's what's been being messaged from Democrats. Republicans thinks it's going to be double than that. It's going to be 4%. Independents are 3.2. Do you just take the independents? Like, is that the best one to look at? You forget the other two.
I mean, it's very interesting to see the opinion and the political affiliation of the people that took that survey. So the Democrats think it's going to be 2. A Republican think it's going to be 4. Independents at 3.2.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you're...
Well, it seems like it's always in the middle, right? The independent seems like we're looking at the chart of this, right?
Yeah.
It's always between the two.
So just look at the independents. It reminds me, though, you know, if let's say the economy was falling apart, and pick a party, Republicans or Democrats, who was ever in party in power that time. It's like Frank Drennan from Police Squad. Nothing to see here, folks. Everything's fine. Everything's good. You know, remember that scene?
Oh yeah, the fireworks shop explodes and there's fireworks blasting all over the place. Yes,
I really like those movies. To be honest with you, they're really good.
Yeah.
All right, a couple odds and ends. Japanese yen the weakest since 1990. I don't know what this means yet. Well, actually, my theory on this is exchange rates are relative to one another. So Japanese yen against the U.S. dollar, you can do it against other currencies. So it hit 153.24, which means you need 153.24 of yen to get one U.S. dollar. The last time it was that weak was March of 1990. And God, I mean, you go back to, what was it, early 70s, over 300 yen to a dollar. It was really weak that back then. So anyway, This does put, in theory, puts pressure on Japanese markets. You know, last week we talked about the developed markets actually beating U.S. markets lately, and you pointed to Japan. I don't know what their markets are going to do, but I just thought this was noteworthy. I know no one watches Japan but me, but I'll put it in here. Any comment?
I started watching a show called Tokyo Vice on HBO.
Oh, boy. All right, let's move on.
No, it's a cop show. I think that's what it's called. All right.
While you were sleeping, gold rally, Jay. That's my note I made. Yeah, while you were sleeping. Remember that movie? What was it? Sandra Bullock and the guy who was the father on The OC. What was his name? Peter.
Yeah, it's like Burrow? Her fiance or pretend fiance, and then she ends up meeting.
The
guy's in a coma.
Yeah. All right. While you were sleeping. Jay, gold, I don't know if you saw this, hit an all-time high.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Michael Saylor has said, you don't want gold because you can't really, you know, travel with your gold bars, but you can travel with your Bitcoin. And what are you going to do? Get your gold bars out of a vault and transport it. But Jay, gold, you know, a lot of people have this in a portfolio, in all seriousness, as a sleeve, sort of a, you know, an anti-correlation. When everything hits the fan, gold will still be okay. It's typically thought of as okay in bad times. I don't think I've seen much about gold.
I blame Costco.
What's Costco doing?
Costco's selling gold bars. Did you know this?
No, I didn't know it.
Yes, you could buy gold bars from Costco, limited amount, but yes, you could now buy a gold bar from Costco. It's kind of hit the news yesterday, I guess, and they've been selling out of gold bars. And I bet it's, you know, knowing Costco, they really significantly reduced the broker commission to buy gold, right? It's not the easiest way to buy gold, right? I guess, I mean, there's a handful of ways, but, you know, but Costco does it, and all of a sudden, gold gets popular, and they keep selling out of gold, Derek. They're selling 1 ounce bars of gold at Costco.
So if I go in there and I give them $2,168 as of this afternoon, I can get one gold bar.
Yeah, I think they make you fill out a bunch of forms and order it, and then it gets shipped to you. It's not sitting in like a case behind, you know, glass or anything like that. You can't just pick it off the shelf.
What do you do? You don't put it on your shelf. You got to put it in a safe. I'd want it on my shelf.
Well, listen, you should buy like a little treasure chest, like a nice little wooden treasure chest that you could bury in the sand where you live, and you could throw your gold bars in it. There you go.
Can I just buy GLD, State Street's product?
If you want to trade it and invest it, you could buy GLD or use options on GLD. You know, we have a fund that it does from time to time, trades GLD. There's probably, you know, more and more popular option strategies that are coming out on that. And yes, you could just, GLD is owns physical gold in it, right? So it's more like a commodity ETF. A lot of talk about that. I am not the expert on 40 Act versus 33 Act products, but yes, you can own GLD and it reflects the value of gold if you just want to trade it in your portfolio or own it in your portfolio. Yes.
So by the way, GLD, its price was 216.81. It's 1/10 the price of gold. And then they also have another one, not a recommendation for either of these, but they've got another one, GLDM, as in Mary. It's the mini. And I think that one is 1/50. Yeah. So that closed today around 46.50 or something like that. So 50 times that. Yep. So I think that's 1/50. And GLD is 1/10 the price of gold.
Yeah, it's got a fairly robust options market, GLD, right? You and I,
very robust,
years have traded GLD quite a bit. So if you're an options person, you could look at gold. You want to look at a managed risk position, a hedge position, or use it to speculate. Options are out there on it too.
Yeah, I mean, we've had people come to us say, "I want to hold a big gold position, but I also want to hedge it." It's kind of our concentrated hedging program that we do.
Yeah, you don't have to then go and, you know, get a futures approved account and that kind of stuff and trade it. No, you can just do it right through GLD, and the options are, like I said, fairly robust. Lots of volume, lots of strikes, lots of expirations.
I always go back. I understand why people buy physical gold. I think it'd be pretty cool to get a gold bar, to be honest with you. I'd have to display it, though. Like,
I actually have a silver bar.
Oh, do you?
I do.
I'd want to display it. I think it'd be pretty cool.
It's a 100-ounce silver bar.
Yeah, but I think gold would look better.
It would look better. Then you just, but you know, your son's friends will come over, and there goes your gold bar.
Are they like, if you drop it, does it break or does it?
It's 100 ounces of metal. Oh, the little, like the 1 ounces are little. They look, I mean, it's like it's smaller than a poker chip, right? I mean, you've seen like a 1 ounce coin. It's like that. It's that.
Oh, size. It's not a gold bar. I'm thinking it's
but they're calling them gold bars because they're in a rectangular shape and they're not a coin. Gold coins start to get into, what's the rarity of the minting? And you got all these other kinds of pricing things that go into gold coins. You just want the commodity, you buy the bar. I call it a tab, actually. It's so small. So, yes.
How much does a gold bar, like if I wanted an actual gold bar?
I mean, it's depending on the weight.
I'd have to fit across two hands.
Two hands, you would have, like one of those, 100 ounce? That'd be like a 100 ounce bar.
Oh, it's 100 ounce.
Yeah. Okay. So 200 grand.
Wasn't there that senator who had a bunch of them in his house?
I don't know. I always think of, when they raided Saddam Hussein's palace, they took out a ton of gold bars.
So Michael Saylor would say to Saddam Hussein, you should have had Bitcoin.
If there was Bitcoin, Saddam Hussein probably would have had it.
It's interesting that, you know, Michael Saylor, I saw an interview and he really made the case against gold. This is his words, not mine. And his point is, you know, if you have gold bars, you've got to store it. Let's say, you know, you stored $1 billion in gold bars. Okay. How do you travel with it? How do you make change with it? You can't really buy anything. And he says, he said Bitcoin has the ability to cross borders, to easily transact. There's no storage cost, things like that. So he was making the case. And I wonder, I'm triangulating back. I can't believe you have me talking about Bitcoin again.
I mean, but brought it up. I didn't.
No, I did bring it up, but he triangulates back. It's like, I wonder if the gold rally right now is very quiet because other people are saying, you know what, it's Bitcoin. Like that's what they're into. They're not buying gold. And I could take the contrarian argument that you can't tell me that Bitcoin is too volatile to be a, you know, a, a hedging asset per se, but I don't, do you think maybe that's it? Like a lot of people are just
you know, there's gold has been over time considered a hedge against inflation. It didn't do much for you in 2022 though. Right. And maybe it's just a little late here. Why it's, I don't know what the move is, you know, what's driving it. It's not like, you know, the dollar is significantly changing. Look, I'm going to use your excuse, Derek. There's just more buyers and sellers in gold right now.
Perfect.
Nice. Look at that. I flipped the table on you. And I love that you brought up, by the way, Michael Saylor is the CEO of MicroStrategies. That is a company that is kind of transforming itself from application and development work to now, I think they call themselves a Bitcoin services company. They hold over 10 billion worth of Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So their company value is highly leveraged to the price of Bitcoin. Michael Saylor is a big believer in Bitcoin. So that's why you referenced Michael Saylor. We've talked about him in the past and you played a little bit of an interview once from him. Just thought I'd connect the dots for everybody. I don't think the Bitcoiners are moving to gold, turning into gold bugs at all.
All right. No, that's fair enough. You do look at the returns of something like gold. Like if you put this in, a lot of people run testing on with gold in there. They run it with bonds. And gold has had these several runs where it's really been a nice non-correlated diversifying agent, provider returns when other things were down. But you've got these spurts where it goes, and sometimes it goes sideways for a while. But you think about like all weather portfolios where you have a bunch of things and you just rebalance once a year. A lot of people put gold in there as, you know, the contrarians would say it doesn't pay a dividend. It doesn't have any cash flows or anything like that. But
you can't do anything with it. It doesn't have a lot of industrial applications like silver does, right? That's always been the knock on gold. It is just a store of value, right? I get the sense you don't own any gold, Derek, physical.
I don't, but I'm looking up Costco's gold bar right now. I want to see a picture of this.
Now, every once in a while, I'll pick up a little bit. I'm not sure what I'll ever do with it, but it sits in the safe. I tried to buy a little treasure chest, by the way. That's what I was joking with you. I was like, I tried to do the same thing. Put a few gold coins in there.
Okay. Somebody is holding it up. Oh, they're little. They're really little.
I told you, tiny, like the size of a poker chip.
Oh, I want one of the gold bars.
You want a 100-ounce gold bar. Yeah. And that'll run you 200 grand. Right.
200 grand.
Well, price of gold times 100, right? So gold trading over 2000. So there you go.
All right. Well,
how about diamonds? You want to pull up diamonds? Is that a good one? That's a whole different ball of wax. Let's do an episode on diamonds.
We should. We'll get one of the guys from what's the street in New York City? Diamond Alley.
In the Diamond District down there? Yeah. I don't remember the street. Yeah.
That's okay. All right. Let's go to recommendations. We got to call this.
All right. I have been watching a show. It's not a lot. The low level of investment. It's kind of moderately entertaining. You can, you know, death scroll on Instagram while you're watching the show. It's called Will Trent. It's on Hulu. Not a bad little detective show. Just seems to be fun for everybody to watch.
You know, I'm going to have to buck it up and get the Hulu without the commercials.
Oh my gosh, yes. You gotta.
It's too much.
I mean, look, you get so spoiled, you know, watching shows, but I'm still watching Shogun. Definitely giving it a good strong recommendation on that. But like you watch you know, I talked to somebody like, I can't watch it. It's got too long commercials. Like we are just spoiled now and you pay extra to have no commercials and it is what it is.
Yeah.
I wish I could watch my CNBC on Yahoo. That's how I watch it on Yahoo TV in the office without commercials. The commercials are really, it's the same darn commercial over and over again. So anybody streaming their CNBC, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Annoying.
Well, Bloomberg does the same thing. I feel like I've seen, because don't they do a local commercial too? So you see local. Yeah. So,
yeah, I know. How do we do it without commercials? But it is, some stuff still has commercials. Yes, get Hulu without the commercials.
I'm going to mention, I still watch Survivor. Now, if you're watching it, don't ruin it for me. Because what I do is, I actually just started watching this season this week. And it's 7 episodes in. And I like to do that, speaking of commercials, because they're taped. And I just fast forward through all the commercials and it cuts down the time. And I hate waiting for like the next week. So one ends, I go to the next one.
So what are you like saving them on a DVR?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, good work, Boomer.
What do you mean?
I watch you stream them like everybody else does these days.
Because I can't cut the commercials.
Like, what is that anymore? You got a VHS, you got a VCR, you're still recording shows.
Yeah, like a Laserdisc, Betamax. No, if I watch it on Paramount, I can't fast forward through the commercials.
There's a commercial-free Paramount Plus, by the way.
I don't like having to wait the week in between. I like a show ending and be like, I don't know what's going to happen.
I like that you queue them up. I do the same thing, but the fact you're DVRing them is hilarious to me.
But then I can fast forward through the commercials. You get that, right?
I get it. These speakers go to 11. You're saying the same thing over again. I get it.
All right. That's
another good reference. Spinal Tap, the movie.
By the time this comes out, too, if you haven't watched The Masters yet, I don't know what time this will come out on Sunday. It might everybody done, but The Masters is this weekend. And that's just such a good tournament as a golf fan. So
yes.
I like that.
Is that hockey?
Don't get me started. We're losing our NHL hockey team. Don't get me started, Jay.
All right.
They're moving to Salt Lake City, Utah.
Your favorite sport.
At least you still have a team that you don't even know about. The Panthers. They're good. Go watch them. See you, Jay. See everyone.
Bye.